Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 103, being recorded on the 18th of November, 2015. My name is Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me, I have my esteemed colleagues, Kale Teeter and Evan Basilek. Guys, good to be back together again. We're going to be doing one of our usual Make It Real shows today. We're going to talk about some real-life scenario that we were approached internally by another avid listener of our podcast, and so that's something that we can cover today. But it looks like we've got a ton of updates to discuss even before we get there. All right, let's see. I have a couple of favorites, but Kale, I'll let you go. What do you like in these updates?
First one is probably about the authentication and authorization expansion for the app service. So if you remember a while back, we introduced this feature with Azure Web Apps where you could, without having to write a lot of code, you could go in and enable authentication using Azure Active Directory to kind of protect your site so that people had to authenticate to even view the site. But the thing was that was kind of closely, and it worked great because then you didn't have to write a lot of code to enable that feature. But the downside was it was kind of locked to Azure Active Directory. And so we introduced some new features to that. And one of the biggest ones is not just Azure Active Directory. Now we can do Facebook, Google, Twitter, all the normal social media type things that people use for different IDPs to authenticate into their site. And so it's a pretty big thing. I think it enables people to protect their sites and be able to use those advanced features without having to do a lot of hand coding. And expanding it to all these other platforms, I think is awesome.
Yeah, I had missed this one. I didn't see that we had launched it till you put it in our notes. But I mean, to me, this is some of the more powerful stuff that we're doing, right? Because we're taking this service that we have, right, the ability to publish your apps and host them, and then now we're layering in this business value of being able to protect them with kind of stock things just through a checkbox, right? I mean, that's, and we're, I guess at that point it's all done by config files and, maybe injecting some code and everything, but, I mean, that's incredibly powerful to let somebody, you could almost see a world where somebody has no idea how to write that stuff. And now they get the functionality just by turning it on.
Yeah, I think the other one that always comes up that I've seen before is people are just getting started with Azure or something in the cloud. And, traditionally, maybe it was on-premises. And in there, they implicitly already had. It was like an internal application, let's say. And then when they went to the cloud, they said, we're thinking about putting this in Azure. But there's a lot of pieces there, right, along with, how they do their authorization and things inside their app. And to bite that all off in one shot and say, well, we have to kind of rewrite the way we do identity management so that we can even put it in the cloud so we can see how this would work, I think this kind of helps that situation.
Yeah, it's tough.
How about you, Evan? What do you like in the recent updates?
I know one thing that I don't know if I like it just because in some ways it scares me, but it definitely caught my attention was the disk encryption stuff. Yep. Because now we're going to allow you to encrypt your OS disks as well. And the thing that jumped out at me that I thought was a really neat way of combining these is, I don't know about you guys, but I managed to get an exemption for my desktop machine right at the office because it doesn't go anywhere, right? It's in the building. It's not portable. I'm not likely to leave it in an airport or something. But before I was able to get the exemption, once in a while my machine would restart and I'd have to call one of the guys in the office and say, hey, can you put in my BitLocker key, so I could get to my machine remotely because I'm working from home. And when I first heard about the disk encryption for Azure VMs, that was the same worry that, and we've actually seen customers do this, right? Where they encrypt the disk, send it up, and then the Azure says, "Yeah, I could start up if you would give me your key, but there's no way to put the key in." But what we did was we integrated this with Key Vault. So now you get the power of the encryption with the automated management of the key. And oh, by the way, technically you could even write it in such a way that you don't even necessarily have your key. You have the ability to call in the Key Vault to tell Key Vault to give the key to compute.
Wow. That
It was,
is
I thought that
impressive.
was a really neat way of combining those capabilities,
Right,
right? You
so
get all the benefits of the encryption without the, hey, somebody still has to know the key. Right? You don't have to deal with that.
the value of the Key Vault is now making itself known.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'd always struggle with Key Vault because it seemed like a really good idea, but I didn't. Like, how you would ever, you had to have something that leveraged that, and you would have to write something. But now it looks like that was probably a framework thing, right, for
Right.
our other services. Because I think SQL Azure supports Key Vault in some context as well for their encryption. I think I remember seeing something about that too.
That's good. That's a very good piece of news that they announced. Well, my favorite, I'm sure no surprise here, I've always been a big fan of the Azure Service Fabric. And I think we spoke about it in one of the previous episodes. I think until now it was primarily a standalone SDK that you would download with second single machine install. You could kind of play around with it, get a free, write some programs, and I explained in the episode how we wrote some test apps for that. But now it's gone into public preview, and what this means now is it's gone to the next level. It's now a normal multi-machine cluster installation, so you could actually install a cluster that spans across machines, which is the true promise of Azure Service Fabric. It's got this really cool web-based the Fabric Explorer. It used to be that it was a little WPF app or a Windows Form app that came with the SDK, and now it's this browser-based system that's much more elaborate and interesting to use. So these are two things. I'll be installing this stuff basically tomorrow as soon as I get back and get into the office. But the one thing that threw me off guard, I was not expecting this, is that they've integrated it with ASP.NET 5 or ASP.NET vNext. And that just makes so much sense, right? This is a system for, this is our new PaaS system, right? The Service Fabric. It'll run both on premises as well as in the cloud. And it makes sense that they got it to work with ASP.NET 5. Coincidentally, ASP.NET 5 or ASP.NET vNext, as we've referred to it in the past, has just hit RC1. So there's a lot of things that are kind of lining up over here. This has become, a preview, a public preview, and ASP.NET 5 as RC1. So this is just a phenomenal coincidence or a well-planned execution.
So does that mean that you're actually deploying your ASP.NET app to Service Fabric natively rather than to, IIS or WCF?
Correct. It would be a reliable service, under Service Fabric, your ASP.NET 5 app. You could have a
So doesn't
multi.
that make it? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Sajid.
No, I was going to say you could have like the multiple nodes, with the failover, you could bring nodes down, it'll automatically switch over and things like that.
Yeah, I guess, and maybe this is my own kind of narrow worldview. I guess I always assumed that ASP.NET and IIS were kind of intimately tied together, but I guess
It is, but
it sounds like they're not.
this is not IIS, right? Service Fabric is not IIS.
Right, no,
It's
that's what I'm saying. But like, every time if you say ASP.NET to me, I just think IIS, right?
correct.
Like, ASP.NET was .NET for IIS web app stuff,
Correct.
right?
And Service
And now
Fabric,
you're able to deploy.
it's like a different hosting environment. It's like something other than
Yeah.
IIS that's hosting it. So they had to have something special in ASP.NET. ASP.NET 5 has pluggable loaders, right, or hosting engines, and so they were able to build another one, I suppose, for Service Fabric in there, like because it's this cross-platform thing, right? You can take ASP.NET 5 code and run it on an OS X box or a Linux box, and obviously in those environments it works differently. Maybe it works with Tomcat or something else over there. So they have this way of having different hosting environments for ASP.NET 5, and the way I read it is they probably have developed one, basically the Microsoft.ServiceFabric.ASP.NET, ASP.NET.Hosting is the namespace which you get from NuGet, and that will allow you to then host these applications inside of the Service Fabric cluster.
So what's the, and this is almost just an idle question, but I have to ask it. What's the difference between ASP.NET hosted in Service Fabric and .NET hosted in Service Fabric?
So that's a good question. I mean, that's basically the question of what's the difference between ASP.NET 4 and ASP.NET 5, right? You can ask the question like that, because regular .NET is ASP.NET 4 or whatever was there before ASP.NET 5. It's the Windows specific, and it was based on Windows only. It was not open source and things like that. ASP.NET 5 now is cross-platform. It's open source, and it has all these pluggable ways where you can host them in different ways. So it used to be ASP.NET 4 was only running on IIS, right? You couldn't run it anywhere else. That was limiting. We could not technically run it inside of something like Service Fabric. It would not have been technically
Yeah, no,
possible.
I get. No, that makes sense. I guess what ASP.NET brings that makes it different than .NET in general is ASP.NET brings the whole HTTP stack and the built-in capabilities around, managing your requests and all that kind of stuff. But I guess I don't know. I just.
Sorry, so that's what you meant. Yeah, it's got the whole MVC engine, right? ASP.NET MVC, we used to call it. You can write web services, you can write web pages, things like that, using .NET constructs. And now you could host that inside of. You could obviously host it in IIS. That's always been available. That's how I've been using ASP.NET 5 until today. But now, tomorrow, I could just drop it into my Service Fabric cluster, and it'll work just as well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm just having a hard time getting my mind wrapped around like it's this whole, it's the same thing as the C# VB.NET thing. There's still .NET. What's the like? Why do you have both? Why do you have ASP.NET and just .NET running in? Because I'm running .NET running in Service Fabric and ASP.NET running in Service Fabric seems redundant. But I'll have to think about it, right? I haven't thought that through, but it.
I mean the ASP.NET 5 is obviously for web-based applications or web services. Those that's it's
Yeah,
limited. It's limit.
right.
It's somewhat limited in that way. You can't write like
Yep.
a general purpose Windows form application, for example, with it's because it's as the name suggests, it's ASP.NET. It's
Right.
only the server side
Right.
stuff.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah, it's but yeah, no, that's incredibly powerful. That really opens up that whole avenue to a lot of people that don't anybody that knows ASP.NET now can use the Service Fabric environment for their hosting. I do have to say, I got to give kudos to the Service Fabric team for the fact that they have party clusters.
Yeah, I was looking at that too.
It looks like it's basically you don't have to deploy it, or you can deploy Service Fabric to a cluster that somebody else owns, or is, I guess, we're providing basically for testing purposes.
Oh, I see.
But I
So
mean, just to
it's a
call it a
general
party
purpose
cluster is kind of
cluster
funny.
that you can drop your code in and try it out, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of funny that there's it's a you know they're whoever did that is showing their age, right? That they remember the concept of party lines and party clusters and that kind of stuff. So.
Nice. Okay, that's good.
Switching gears a little bit, the one, the I thought this was really cool. Maybe people don't think this is cool, but I thought it was awesome because I've been looking for this forever, or trying to figure this out myself forever, was around Resource Manager ARM and what's available in ARM, what's not available in ARM. So there's actually a page up there now in our documentation up on Azure.com that shows pretty much all the services up there and will tell you which portal they're in, whether you can move them easily, if they're ARM enabled. I think it's that's a massive thing for me anyhow. Yeah, but
Agreed. I support the stuff, and I don't always know what's in ARM and what's not. So I think it's great.
So we'll drop that link out in the link top.
Yep. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the new Azure SDK 2.8, version 2.8 that came out. There's a bunch of, since you mentioned ARM, there's some ARM updates in there. You could now author the templates in Visual Studio itself. It's got IntelliSense support and whatnot. And a bunch of other updates for Docker, mobile apps template, and also a new Azure Storage Explorer. You know, today in the past, in order to dip into Azure Storage, we've used Azure Storage Explorer, right? It's a standalone application. A Windows application that you use to enumerate all your queues, blobs, tables, files, etc. And you can do all sorts of updates. That's how I update the podcast files using that tool. And now that's going to be integrated into the SDK, which means it'll be integrated into Visual Studio as well. So that'll be cool.
And I think one thing to note on that, like in the fine print there, non-Windows computers. That wasn't possible before with Azure Storage Explorer.
Right. I missed that point. You're right.
Oh, I missed that too. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was really neat that to see that this is on, you know, non-Windows platforms. I wonder if we're, you know, leveraging .NET or whether we're recompiling this. I assume it's .NET and we're taking advantage of that on the different platforms. But, I mean, that's amazing to see more and more things on non-Windows platforms, right? We're doing what we said we were going to do.
I agree. Yep. Cool stuff. All right. What else? Anything else that's new and interesting?
Yeah, and the last one was around dev test. So there's a new...
That's right.
It's called Labs out here. Yeah, this is... I didn't hear this coming. Like, I just saw when it was announced. It's in preview now. And I don't know. Do you know much about this, Sajid? Have you seen it before?
Well, I mean, I just read about it today, as probably you did as well. It seemed like it was a way where it's like a portal, right, where you can go in there and request test VMs for your enterprise and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's wrapping up some of the things that, you know, the common things that you have to do when you're doing these kind of, I won't call them temporary, but they're kind of like these little environments that you spin up to do dev test or these things to test your code and whatnot. And it's not like it has to be like production, quality, strength, all that kind of thing. But then also it's like we don't need to leave it running 24 hours a day. So the stuff for, you know, that's what people usually do, right? They start saying, okay, we need to have a dev test lab. They'll go figure out what images they got to build or machines and what other infrastructure. Now with ARM, it's easier, right, because we can kind of template that. But the other piece is like, how do we shut down the VMs tonight? Well, we need a script to do that that's kind of built in here, right? So it's like a package to kind of do that stuff, wrapping up things that are kind of annoying that you'd have to do yourself.
Right. Oh, come on. I don't know. I kind of like it when that meter runs all night long.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, we got to drive up consumption.
Yeah, that, I guess that's what happens when we work for the company rather than the company paying the bill, right?
Now, this thing always kind of worried me. It's like if you were to implement something like this where you had to have a VM that you spin up and emulate some sort of a dev environment that you have, maybe in production, but you have a smaller test version of it, you'd have to spin it up based on an image and then get a whole bunch of products or whatever code deployed on it, right, to bring it up to snuff, to bring it up to par with your test environment, and then run your tests on it. What do we use for that? Do we use something like DSC to do that, or how do we get it?
It looks like you've got access to like Chocolaty and stuff, so I assume that you have kind of some of the standard DSC stuff. Plus, I mean, I didn't see mention of. Oh, actually, I take it back. I can see the Chef clients there. The you know Chocolaty's there. You know, so it looks like there's you can kind of pre-select some things that you want to put on there. And some of them are just stubs for other things, right? Like if you put the Chef client on there, you can put whatever you want on there.
Right, because you're going to have your own custom stuff to put on there, right? That's the whole idea, is to put your custom stack on there or code and then run a whole bunch of tests on it.
Yeah, I think the thing that's different about this that I saw was like how that is configured, right? They have these templates up there with ARM now and these UIs, so you can say, I'm creating this lab and I want to add, they call them artifacts, But like, I think that's what you're saying, Evan. Like, you can like just click on these things and say, yeah, I want this, 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 and this, and then it'll just handle that for you. But it's not even that you have to go on the machine and type commands to do that. You're telling Azure, go spin up this VM and then bring these other 10 packages along with it.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, you wouldn't be installing the Chef client if you didn't have some Chef script that went with it.
Sure.
Right. I mean, so it's kind of like that's the stub to the next set of things that you install via that way. I agree with you guys. I mean, I thought this was really neat. I kind of have to absorb it a little bit. I mean, this, I don't know about you guys, but I got the email like 4 hours ago. Some of this stuff was brand new. So, it looks pretty cool.
Cool. All right. So shall we get to the topic of the day, our make it real scenario?
Sure.
Okay. So, we had, one of our, colleagues reach out to us, happens to be one of our listeners, he presented a scenario to us that he's been trying to figure out, which was fairly interesting. There's a company, you know, we'll just kind of say it's financial services. They need to obviously maintain these very low latency transactions that they have to do in that particular industry. And they're doing a lot of the stuff in Azure today. They're using IaaS to do it, and they're looking at ways to maybe get this done in a PaaS environment because you want to take advantage of the automatic failover and the fact that you can just scale up and scale down as required using PaaS. But they had some concerns about whether they could meet their low latency requirements, whether the SLA is something we could manage in PaaS. Does that kind of summarize the question?
Yeah, I think the one thing that we do want to make sure that we point out, because this, as soon as we went back to him and he added some more detail that I remember the last time I dealt with something like this, but when they talk about low latency, they're talking about really low latency, right? I mean, they're talking on the order of single digits, ideally, milliseconds, and you know, at worst, you know, 10 type milliseconds. So when he says fast, he really means fast.
Right. And I mean, and obviously the first thing that came to my mind is that one of the first things you have to do is you have to have some sort of an express route, right, to Azure. I mean, isn't that kind of a requirement if you want to have something like this?
I actually think that probably right there kills you. And to be clear, like, you know, you guys know I love ExpressRoute. I like supporting it, but you know, your ExpressRoute is driven by the speed of light, right? So if I'm going from some on-premises to the Azure data center, you know, the speed of light, you know, just rough approximation, if you're going across the U.S. about 3,000 miles, it's about 70 milliseconds, right? So if you're going any substantial distance, you're picking up a whole bunch of latency that, you know, it really doesn't add anything for you unless you have some regulatory or compliance need to have a piece of your app on premises. So I think the first thing, if you were doing this, is got to assume 100% Azure for the real-time stuff. Like maybe you async some stuff back on-prem, but your
right.
real-time stuff has to be 100% Azure.
So what you're saying is that obviously the web front end has to be on Azure as well as the processing engine.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So in that case, then obviously having ExpressRoute even just to present the web, okay, so the web thing can come over the internet, and then once you're in here, it's fast, it's all internal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that, kind of where I'm thinking about this as we think through this is that the minute I have to travel any significant physical distance, right, that's where there really is a limit to how fast you can speed that up.
Got it.
Right. So minimize your, in the on-premises world, right, and you can read about people doing this, but, you know, for the financial companies, they pay big bucks to be physically closer to the exchanges.
Right.
Right, because they want those extra couple of milliseconds or fractions of a millisecond. So, you know, again, maybe some portion of the app sits on premises, but it's not the real-time piece. Right? Maybe the OLT, you know, the data warehouse is on-prem or something like that. But, you know, I think the processing engine and the UI that talks to it has to be 100%.
Got it.
In the cloud.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, it's kind of tricky when you start talking about guaranteeing how many milliseconds this service is going to respond every single time to potentially millions of requests, possibly. I mean, Azure's doing that right now, but so I think that's kind of a tricky question. But the thing is, if you start talking about things like table storage, for instance. That one specifically always sticks out for me, and blob storage is a little bit the same. But anytime we're talking to one of those services, for me, it always comes down to setting it up correctly and having your like your data laid out correctly. How you're going to store this thing to get the maximum throughput. We can't 100%, you know, we may not be able to get 100% thing saying we will guarantee less than 5 milliseconds every time you hit this. But I can guarantee you that if you don't partition things correctly, like in table storage or do things like that, you will definitely have much more overhead. So I think the scrutiny around your schemas and how things are partitioned and laid out, if there's any kind of sharding that's happening across blob storage, table storage, whatever, even databases, is like super, super critical in the, in those needs.
Does this say that, you know, we and I, you know, I unfortunately wasn't able to make it last week, but you guys had that really good conversation with Yoast, right, talking about the in-memory OLTP for Azure SQL Database. I got to think that something like that really would maybe you use table storage as your backing, you know, one of your backings, but you know, if you have the ability to do something like that in-memory in SQL Azure, that brings relational right back into the picture. Where, you know, for, you know, a year ago, people would roll that out just out of course. They say, hey, you know, relational is not fast enough because of the, you know, the structures that are enforced and the fact that I am, you know, writing to disk and all that. Well, if I can keep it in memory, man, that's going to give me some extra speed right there.
Right, but
Yeah, and I think.
there's still the hops, right? Getting to the database. I mean, having it in memory just means that there's no disk involved, right? The
True.
server is processing all the data in memory, but the client or whatever the application is has to still access the server over some hop.
TCP stack, yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah, I guess.
so are you thinking, Sajid, you're thinking some way, oh, maybe, here, now we're right back to Service Fabric.
Exactly. You read See, you read my mind.
yeah, so maybe what you know, are you thinking that what they would want to implement is some application in Service Fabric, because then theoretically, and again, be interesting to see exactly how we implement this, is can I, because I think you can, is deploy your VM with Service Fabric on it, and then you have your Service Fabric instances on multiple VMs as well for your
No,
redundancy, but you try and keep it all in one.
remember, Service Fabric is available both in Azure and on premises, right? You don't think of VMs. There is a, it's a first class Azure service now.
Right, no. Well, yeah.
So
So maybe I'm.
there's no VMs. You have
Oh,
a
that's right. It's
pre-configured
directly.
Azure Service
Yeah,
Fabric
that's right.
environment now. It just got released today, or yesterday, and one of the things that we talked about when we did the podcast is this concept of a reliable service. And a
Yeah.
reliable service has access to something called a reliable collection. And reliable collections are amazing because they basically give you in-memory collections that can be accessed across any all the nodes, and they're all kept in sync. All right. And one of the requirements that the gentleman had was that they had to have some shared information between
Yeah.
all the
Yeah.
nodes or the machines in the in this particular environment. So I at least one of the thoughts that I had was that just like what you said, Gavin, is that we could use something like reliable collections to achieve that very goal of the middle tier processing engine. There's still the question to be talked about though, how do we get the stuff over to the processing engine from the front end or the UI tier in a very fast and low overhead way, right? Because it's going to be all these messages coming in really fast.
I
I
mean,
toward go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, doesn't this go back to right where we started today, which is ASP.NET running in
Well,
Service Fabric?
ASP.NET is yeah, you're right. That's on the you could run ASP.NET in here for sure, or you could use the web apps, right? Because he wants to use the PaaS environment as much as he
Oh,
can and not have to build his own. So he, I guess he might use like the app service, right? Our app service, and use the web app in there. But from the web app, they got to get to this middle-tier processing engine, which is on Service Fabric. I guess, Kale, they could use something like the Event Hubs, right? Isn't that a very low-latency system that we offer for passing in messages?
Yeah, for ingestion of huge amounts. Basically, it's a partitioning algorithm that we have sitting on top of Service Bus on the input side. So we can basically kind of spread that load across a lot of the kind of nodes servicing those requests inside for the intake only, right? So those things were going to come in super fast, and then we would have to have something obviously picking them up and processing. I don't know. The thing I think about too with these, especially when they're like way down in the weeds with this one, like how many milliseconds, it's very closely controlled. Like financial transactions, like on trading and things like that, like in Wall Street, those milliseconds are everything. Like because people lose a lot of money that way, but and gain. But the thing is, I always come back to like you got to keep the data close to wherever you're processing it. Just like you said, Shajid, any more hops that you put in there. It's just like Evan said too, it's the speed of light, it's these different things that have to be instantiated, like the TCP stack and things like that. So all the time I hear people say, oh, Redis is great, and Redis is great for like a distributed cache. It works awesome for that. It's perfect and it's super fast. But there's still network, right? We still have to go over the network to hit that thing. If we had it on the roll itself, whatever's running that thing, where it's in memory on that server. And so for in these cases, for me, like if there's like shared data that needs to be close to wherever we're doing the processing for that speed, who cares? We'll replicate it multiple times, right? We'll just have that same thing, that same structure that we need there. Using extra memory on those VMs, we don't care about that because all we're cared about is how fast we can access it.
And that's what the distributed collections does, right? It maintains all these replicas, right? There's the primary replica, the primary server node, and then there's n number of replicas, and there's copies of all these data, these collections everywhere, so that it can never go down. That's one way to do it. So are you suggesting that they use the Redis to do something similar? Is that where you were going with that comment?
No, I'm actually suggesting the opposite. I'm suggesting keep it local.
Keep it
Whatever
local.
machine we're running on, yeah, for these types of applications. Now, maybe you could have a tiered cache, which is something I usually favor a lot. Like, we use Redis because we can protect the database, right? So Redis is our shield. And then keep it local as well, because that's going to be like super fast. And then we can kind of hit that overhead if we need to go get something. We'll go through Redis to get it.
Yeah, I think the I what I and I was just poking around some of the documentation for Service Fabric. We don't seem to talk about it, but it wouldn't surprise me if there, if as this continues to roll out, there's more capabilities. There's like the ability that you see with PaaS VMs and IaaS VMs and app service services. That's not the right word, but what web apps became. You have the ability to basically say, I want my own hardware. By going to a certain size VM, I don't want to share with anybody else. I wonder if, as we continue to grow Service Fabric, if you're going to have the ability to say, hey, I want all my services on a minimum number of VMs so that I'm minimizing latency between these microservices that I have out there.
Yeah, I
I don't know.
mean, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to specify how many nodes you want and that you want it to more dedicated infrastructure. Yeah, that'll be something that is certainly forthcoming. And just to comment on the event hubs, like I mentioned earlier, I was just looking up some of the, there aren't any specific SLAs that are mentioned in any of the documentation. They don't tell you like, oh, it takes so many microseconds or whatever. But it does say that event hubs can process millions of transactions per second. Okay. Now, if we do the math on that, that comes up to a very small number for in terms of processing time, the throughput and the latency. So that's I think that's a good kind of that's a good way for them to get this very high speed connect between their app and their UI tier and the app tier.
Yeah, no, I think that, kind of summing it up, I don't think we answered his question, but I think we raised a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, on the I mean, I think service bus or event hubs, well, event hubs are based on service bus, so it's kind of a souped up service bus, you could say, right? I think we all agree that that's probably the way to go, right? For the communications angle. And the only question I had about event hubs is, can you do a request response? Like, can you send the response back to the caller? Right? I know a lot of people, like all the, a lot of the use cases for sub for event hubs is one way, right? You're sending in a lot of messages, but you should be able to send back as well, I suppose, right? It just be on a different channel, I think. It's not like the same channel. It's not like typical web service where you send a request and you wait for a response. I'm not sure that event hubs work like that. Event hubs is okay. Here's something and go and send it, and then you gotta wait for on another channel to get the response back.
Yeah, I think they're yeah, they're not a request response
Right.
inherently.
Because they use primary, I mean, one of the main use cases for service for event hubs is the IoT scenarios, and in IoT, you're primarily sending data in one way from the IoT device out to the internet, but there are also data coming back, the command data, right, to control command and control data that comes back to the IoT device, and there's got to be a way for it to, there's got to be a channel back. So that's the one thing that perhaps needs to be looked into.
I wonder too, and this is not specifically a cloud thing, but I wonder in these types of systems if something leveraging something like SignalR or some of those types of connections would be advantageous, right? Because we're keeping that connection open real time, and we can have, our client directly connected receiving those events very fast.
That is a very good idea if you want to build like more like a JavaScript client, right? Running in the browser and then using SignalR to get out there. That's a good, very good idea. I like that. Good. So we got SignalR maybe on the front end, then event hubs as the interconnect, and possibly using Service Fabric on the processing engine on the app tier. Well, that's a bunch of things for the person to consider, and hopefully that also raises some, I give some ideas to some of our listeners how they can kind of use Azure PaaS to handle very low latency, high volume, real-time systems, right? This is what we're talking about here. And yes, it can be done. It takes a little bit of tweaking, a little bit of adjustment, but I think all the tools are there.
Yeah, no, I think the one thing that, and this just occurred to me, right? The first time I ever ran into this type of scenario was, golly, I mean, it was probably 7, 8 years ago. Now we had our customer say, "Hey, I'm using an Adio.NET data table as my in-memory construct, and I'm trying to read and write to it." There were some challenges to that because that object is not serializable for writes, just for reads. So, he had all kinds of, concurrency issues. But now, like, that was a relatively simple implementation. Now we just, we spent, what, 20 minutes talking about all the different ways you could do this, and there's a whole lot more complexity, but at the same time, you get a whole lot more capability and scale out of it, right? I mean, the customer I was working with years ago, he had this big entire app he had to build around this one little core functionality, and it still didn't do everything and have the scale and the redundancy that you get by default now with some of the things we were talking about today. I think that's, it sounds more complicated on paper, but I think in the end you get to build something that's much better.
I agree. I agree. I mean, you get the infinite, quote unquote, infinite scale up. You could just turn a knob and get more processing, or bring it down maybe during the evening times. If it's a financial application, you probably have to need it from 9 to 5 or whatever, right? You don't really need it all the time. So there's a lot of things you could set up to adjust and get more bang for the buck that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You could double your size during the day because you don't only have to run it during the day,
That's correct.
Versus what you would in the old days. So,
All
no,
right.
definitely very cool.
Great. Thanks. That was a good discussion. I appreciate that. I appreciate all your input. And we'll put some of the links that we talked about in the show notes. And then we'll hope you guys, I mean, next week, looks like Evan, you're going to be doing, I mean, Evan and I will be on the road next week during the usual time, but we're going to see if we could get, we have an interesting guest lined up for next week, and we're going to see if we can maybe record a little earlier so we can all get on the show. Otherwise, Cale's going to do that one alone, right, Cale?
I don't know. Are we sure we want to leave Kale alone? I mean, you know,
I
no
know.
supervision, no
Yeah,
nothing.
it might be a completely different show, you know. Instead of the Azure
I
podcast, it'll be Kale's special podcast with talking about Xbox One and whatnot, you know.
Halo Tactics,
Halo Tactics.
Yeah. Well, Halo runs on top of Azure somewhere, right? I'm sure. You know, so. Well, no, cool. Yeah, definitely. We'll try and see if we can hook up next week early, because we wouldn't want to disappoint all the people out there that are, you know, at 9:30 on the 25th or 10 o'clock, you know, or whatever, when we post it, they're looking for it just to get it right away.
That's right. While they're waiting in line at the Black Friday deals.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yes. Good talking to you guys.
Sounds good, guys. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.